It's Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Tyne.
And I'm Bonnie North. Monday on the show, we featured some in-studio and, in one case, in a cave, musical performances. Yesterday was our annual all-music holiday show. And today on the show, we're going to feature some more conversations about music.
Christmas has passed, so you may not hear any more renditions of Jingle Bells and White Christmas in 2018, but music is with us year-round. And according to a recent Nielsen study, Americans are actually listening to more music than ever.
For many of us, music is a source of great joy and often a way to get through difficult situations. Professor Daniel Levitin is a neuroscientist and author of This Is Your Brain on Music.
He explains to Lake Effect's Mayan Silver why music helps us so much, starting with what happens to your brain when you listen to music.
Well, that's a big question. There's all kinds of things happening when you listen to music you like, but I think one of the most interesting things is that it activates the well-known pleasure center of the brain. The same part of the brain that gives you pleasurable feelings when you're hungry and then you finally eat, when you're an alcoholic and you have a drink, when you have sex, and music activates that same region of the brain, the kind of the sex, drugs, and rock and roll area.
Have you done studies where you're looking at people's brains when what activates when they're listening to music?
We have. We haven't had them drink or have sex in the scanner, but other people have done that. But we had people come in and listen to music, and we show activation in those same pleasurable brain regions.
There's really no single language center or single music center in the brain, right?
That's right. We used to think that maybe 25 years ago. Now we realize that as far as language and music are concerned and many other things, they're distributed in vast, far-reaching networks throughout the brain. And some of the most recent evidence suggests that music and language use the same circuits, but that the neurons are functioning in different modes depending on whether it's music or language.
Wow. So what is going on in the brain when you listen to a piece of music that you like?
Well, as I said, it activates the pleasure center. That includes the nucleus accumbens and the ventral tegmental area. It releases dopamine, which is in that part of the brain responsible for feelings of reward. I don't want to go too far off the track, but dopamine's an interesting chemical because it does different things at different parts of the brain. In the frontal lobes, it helps you to pay attention and stay focused. In the limbic system, it delivers pleasure. The other things that might happen when you hear music that you like is that it could increase your mood, release serotonin, or allow the serotonin that's already in your brain to stay around longer, which elevates your mood.
Why does certain music elevate your mood in certain pieces when certain people listen to it and other people it doesn't have that effect?
This is the million-dollar question, and we don't know. There's no one piece of music that everybody likes. There's no one piece of music that everybody hates. It's so subjective. And so when we're talking about pleasurable music, what we're talking about is music that the individual finds pleasurable, not that the experimenter or the professor says ought to be pleasurable. That's a whole different thing.
And so what are some of those things that help us develop tastes in music and things that we like?
Well, you know, I'm sorry not to have the answer to that. It's hard to say. There are individual differences in aesthetic taste that span all domains of taste. So some people like spicy food. Some people have a sweet tooth. Why? Why is that? Well, it has a partly genetic basis, partly a basis in your experiences and things you've been exposed to growing up, the kinds of things that were reinforced. And then there's a random factor. We just don't know. The interesting thing is that one dimension we've mapped is openness to new experiences. This probably is something that makes intuitive sense. Some people are more open to new experience and others are less. And that shows up in their preferences for music and their preferences for food. You probably know somebody that you know who you go out to a meal with and they always want to eat at the same restaurant. And once they get there, they want to order the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then you know other people who are always checking Zagat. They want to find the newest restaurant, the newest thing. And, you know, that's a personality trait that has a genetic basis, a neural basis, an experiential basis. All those factors contribute to it. And they show up in musical taste, too.
So is that something that you can develop? Like, with time, you can start to like certain types of things that you're exposed to more often?
You know, to a certain extent, our musical taste is greatly influenced by what we hear between the ages of 12 and 20. Part of it has to do with brain development and the pubertal growth hormones and just the way the brain is maturing. The stuff that happens through those years seems vitally important. And it's not just music that we have a better memory for from that period. We remember a lot of things better from that period of our lives. That partly influences our openness to different kinds of music. If we heard lots of different kinds of music in that age range, we're more likely to seek multiple kinds of music later. It's something you can make an effort to do. You can make an effort to go out and listen to new concerts, new symphonies, new, expose yourself to new paintings, new dance, all art forms. Whether it'll take or not, depends on your brain and your genetics.
Well, you talked about in your book, for example, with Latin rhythms. There's all types of different sounds, different rhythms and textures. And you said that you've worked with people that may not initially appreciate it, but then once you teach them the rhythms, they start to appreciate it.
I think that education is a part of it. So I remember when I was a kid, to my parents, the Beatles were indistinguishable from Led Zeppelin and Jimi Hendrix. It all sounded the same to them. But that was 50 years ago. Now, they've been exposed to it. They've learned a little bit about it through me and my sister and other young friends they have. And now that knowledge helps them to appreciate it. I didn't really understand Latin rhythms until I started playing in an Afro-Cuban band. And then I grew a taste for it. And I know a number of other people who did too, through education and exposure.
And so the people that are seeking out new songs and listening experiences, is something happening to their brain that doesn't happen to the people that aren't seeking out those new musics?
Everything you do changes your brain. That's what experience is. This conversation we're having is changing both of our brains. If you eat a pickle after we get off the phone, that's going to change your brain. Every sensory, perceptual experience, every idea, thought you have changes the brain in some chemical way. That's what experience is. That's what learning is. So at some level, people who seek new music are changing their brains, but people who don't are changing their brains. What may happen as you, I think what the answer that you were after.
Which... No, that's a perfect answer. I love that answer.
I think what people mean to get at when they ask a question like that is, is there a benefit? Or, what's the interesting way in which my brain is changing? And when you experience something new, your brain forms a pathway that represents that experience. And then the more times you repeat that experience, the more learned, the deeper the pathway becomes, and it allows you to access it. Now, that doesn't mean you'll like it, but familiarity is part of aesthetic appreciation of anything. I was thinking about this just the other day. I had a foot massage, and the person pressed on a part of my foot that if I had been tied up by gangsters and they were, threatening me, and they caused that pain in my body, I would give them the combination to the safe or whatever, right? But I would reveal state secrets if only I had them, if only someone had trusted me with them. But here, in the context of a massage, I know that there's a greater benefit, and so I don't experience it as pain. So the complicated thing here is listening to music that's unfamiliar to you, the way you react to it depends on your mental attitude. Am I improving myself? Am I expanding my musical horizons? Do I like the person who's exposed this to me and trust them? Or am I stuck in an elevator between floors and this new music is bombarding me and I can't turn it off?
So it's obviously the context in which they're consuming the music, but also their personality. I mean, there's multiple factors that go into it then, right?
Yes.
When you have developed those tunnels and those pathways to particular styles of music and you get really connected to it, if you're appreciating it, what is happening to your brain?
Well, at that point, when the music becomes familiar, it makes you feel good. It makes you feel comforted. It allows you to anticipate some of the pleasures that are coming up next in the song that you've heard before. The other thing that happens as we hear a piece more and more as we learn it, we know what to expect, and that can be comforting.
Are there studies that are showing that listening to music can be, I mean, obviously there's musical therapy, but can music be a medicine in almost some regards?
Oh, absolutely. There's a lot of work on this lately. And in fact, the National Institutes of Health has just issued a call for research proposals where they want to fund a few million dollars worth of studies looking at music and health.
And what are some of the things that have been found and are you're maybe hoping that can be looked at?
Well, what's driving this, Francis Collins, by the way, the director of the NIH, is a musician. And during his watch at the NIH, a number of studies have been done. But this is the first time there's been an actual subfield of music and health, music and medicine, created within the National Institutes of Health. Some of the findings we've seen along the way are that people in a preoperative theater about to undergo surgery, normally in that environment you give them Valium or one of the benzodiazepines to calm them down. And in one study, people were either given that or they were given relaxing music to listen to. And the ones who were given music to listen to did a much better job of getting through the surgery. Their blood pressure stayed more stable, they were more relaxed, they had better outcomes, and all this without the use of drugs. I mean, benzodiazepines are addictive, they have side effects. I mean, I suppose you could say that music is addictive and have side effects, but it's not the same thing at all.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned relaxing music. Are certain styles of music doing different things in our brain when we listen to them, serving different functions, or is it all sort of hitting the same kind of familiarity pleasure system in our brain?
Well, yeah, there's a lot more to it than that. So some music relaxes us. That releases perhaps prolactin, the soothing hormone that's released between mothers and infants during nursing. Relaxing, comforting music, sad music probably involves prolactin. Listening to music that's energizing, like to help you get through your workout, like we've seen athletes use in practices. That music might release adrenaline to help pump you up. It seems as though different styles of music, different emotional styles of music, elicit different neurochemical reactions in the brain and evoke different neural circuits that contribute to the feelings that we get. Another one is knowledge. Some music with lyrics is really about imparting information. Look at a number of songs we had as kids, like the ABCs. You learn the alphabet to a melody, right? Or you learn the body parts through melody. You put your right foot in, you put your right foot out, you shake it all about, you do the hokey pokey, and that, Mayan, is what it's all about.
Your brain is producing different responses to different types of music, and we know that, right?
As yes.
Like when we listen to it, so then we seek it out, right?
Right.
And so...
And we do. There are a number of studies that show that people tend to use music kind of like a drug. They know that there's certain music they want to reach for because of the way it'll make them feel. So you would listen to a different kind of music trying to get out of bed in the morning than you would trying to fall asleep at night. There's a certain set of songs that you might gravitate towards after you've had a fight with a loved one and you're trying to recover your sanity. And there's music that we use to help us clean the house. We sort of use music the way we use drugs to influence mood.
Where are the new frontiers in terms of figuring out how music can be used instead of drugs, instead of alcohol, instead of various things to affect mood? And I mean, are there frontiers on that?
Yeah, I think that's what music therapists are working towards. The interesting part of all this is that many of us self-medicate, and we do a pretty good job of it. We have very strong, the average person, even a non-musician, non-music therapist, has very strong intuitions about what kinds of music are going to make them feel certain ways. And we reach for them, we create playlists, we go into Spotify or one of the streaming services and say, I want music that sounds like that, and we hope that that's what'll be delivered. But even if you have a favorite song of all time, it doesn't mean you want to hear it all the time. There, you want to hear it when it's, you know, consonant with certain moods that you're trying to achieve, and that's not always the way you feel throughout the day.
What does it say about people who don't use music as a form of mood therapy or mood medication?
Well, I mean, everybody has their own way of coping with the ups and downs of life, right? Music isn't for everybody. We've got genetic diversity. It's estimated that 10% of the people in the world just don't like music, and it doesn't move them at all. And, you know, that sort of falls out of Darwinian theory. You've got genetic diversity to prevent a lack of diversity in the genome from allowing a single virus to wipe out the whole human race. So there's all this random mutation trying to stay ahead of viruses and bacteria. Some of it means that you've got people who don't like chocolate. You've got other people who don't like sex. You've got people who don't like music. That's just the way it is.
And on the flip side, is there like a 10% or a 5% or something of people that are like have levels of obsession with music that are more than the average?
Well, you're talking to one of them.
I guess you're talking to one of them, too. Well, Daniel Levitin, thank you so much for speaking about this.
Thank you. Nice to speak with you.
Daniel Levitin is a neuroscientist at McGill University in Montreal. He's also the author of the 2008 book, This Is Your Brain on Music, and he's the editor of a book due out this spring called Foundations of Music Psychology. He spoke with Mayon Silver.